Thanks, Wendy, for that too kind information and introduction of me. So I had the privilege and honor of being a part of this writing process with Wendy, and then she ended up asking me to write the foreword to her book. So I'll read that now. One day, my friend Kelsey says to me, "There's a woman who writes stories in our cafe. She's been looking for some help typing them up on a computer because she's a little older and has been writing them out by hand." That was what I was first told about Wendy Woodfield, and already I wanted to know more. As an enthusiastic reader, I was eager to get my hands on these stories, but I also wondered about the person writing them. The day I finally met Wendy was a typical afternoon for me. I was between meetings and had just enough time for a caffeine pit stop, so I headed to Burismo, my favorite cafe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. "She's here today, right over there," Kelsey gestured over at a corner table. I looked over and spotted a woman hunched over a notebook with a pen in hand and a cappuccino beside her. She looked like someone not to be disturbed. But curiosity got the better of me, and I gave her a tap on the shoulder. "Hi, I'm Sandy. Sorry to interrupt, but my friend Kelsey told me that you're a writer and you're looking for some kind of help." I ended up delaying those other meetings I had later on in the day. Wendy began to describe to me her stories as brief moments from my life. She went on to say that they were short and concise stories that captured an interaction or a scene from her past. I was instantly intrigued by this older woman who sat in this cafe every day, scrawling away on pads of paper and had filled many marble-covered composition notebooks. It wasn't merely her diligence that I was in awe of, or her energy and dedication to her writing that I admired. I realized that what drew me into Wendy's stories was that her experiences of moments in time are so foreign to my own understanding. My idea of moments in time happen in 140 characters on Twitter, or it takes 0.02 seconds to like them on Facebook, timelines dotted with mundane updates from family and friends. But within the shuffled pile of papers and notebooks, Wendy was talking about the moments that she carries with her and have shaped her into the person she is today. The pages you will read are filled with the moments she survived and others that she celebrated. Wendy continued to tell me that she aspired for the collection of stories to someday be turned into a book. At this point in the conversation, there was a little bit of uncertainty in her voice, but her persistence at describing a vision for the final product never ceased. Our moments began after that initial conversation when we agreed to meet at the Cambridge Public Library, and it has been that way ever since, every week for 3 hours at the library. I was a timid and cautious partner during these sessions at first. Mostly, I took a back seat and shrugged whenever Wendy asked, "What do you think of this paragraph? Do you think there's enough conflict? What word should be replaced here?" "It's up to you, Wendy," I always said in response. Across all of these memories Wendy shared, I never thought I could possibly add or give anything to a life that included experiencing the throes of the hippie movement, being an enterprising youngster in the suburbs of Massachusetts, a woman torn between motherhood and civic engagement, and an idealistic professional fresh out of Wellesley College. And yet, she kept beckoning for my input. No, I want your opinion on this. You have become a co-editor in this process, Sandy. You are no longer just a scribe," Wendy would insist. "The results you have in your hands now are moments from Wendy's past, her present ambitions, and the sweat of creation. Wendy had made me feel welcomed, and I realized that the recording of these stories feels so close to me because the invitation to join her is always open. Whether trying to provide access to birth control in Venezuela in the mid-1960s, or reuniting with an old college classmate at their 50th reunion, these connections endure in our minds long after the final period of each story. My time spent with Wendy has taught me that moments are not to be glanced over or passively scrolled down a computer screen. All of our lives are composed by the distinct symphony from an ensemble of individuals whose breaths are drawn together at the wave of a baton. Every exhaled note and every rest is precious and worthy. All of the dissonance and harmony deserves to be included to create the fullness of one movement. I'd like to extend Wendy's invitation to you as readers into this movement, and I hope that, like me, you too will feel as welcomed in these moments. Wendy, thanks for waving your baton. Your audience is listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy. I'm so glad to see so many faces that I kind of know and kind of don't know. It's a wonderful place to be, and I'm so grateful to be here tonight. This is the end of a long journey, and I hope that you all get a chance to have the same kind of journey, to find your own voice and put it down in some form, writing or saying or anything, because that's what life's about. And I share these stories with you as a way to let you know that we can be whole, become more whole. Never perfect, but more whole. The first story is called Nonconformist Preteen. My glasses. My eyesight is certainly not perfect. Nonconformist preteen, dressed in long brown stockings and a garter belt to hold them up to my thighs, an outfit dictated by my grandfather, a doctor, to keep me warm during the cold months of New England, I learned to be different in the 1950s. All the other girls in school wore short white ankle socks, no matter the temperature. No matter the temperature. They questioned me in gym class when we changed into our comfortable outfits. Wendy, why do you bother with those ugly long things? And doesn't that grown-up contraption hurt you? Even my close friends asked me. My grandfather is a doctor, and he doesn't want me to catch cold, I explained. After Isadora Duncan's style dance class, where I translated music into bodily moves and circling chiffon scarves to delineate the emotion and story of Greek myths, I dropped down to earth in the dressing room. No, I don't mind changing into my Sears stockings, I respond to staring eyes. They keep me warm. At home, my dad beckoned me to the black and white television set to witness The Witch Hunt by Senator Joseph McCarthy, who accused free thinkers of being communists, destroying their reputations and future. I still wore my warming gear. Boys and girls elected me to head the combined council of sixth graders for the town of Wellesley. They did not choose me on the basis of my wearing apparel, although I preened in my secondhand navy blue jumper with a red elastic cummerbund on the first day in office. I pounded the gavel. My outside belt buckle popped open. Everyone laughed. Notions of grandeur, though modest in middle school, subsided for now. Later in high school, I told Dad, I'd like to be the first woman governor of Massachusetts. Why not? Replied my father. Oh, I see somebody in the back. Has there been any governor elected of Massachusetts yet, a woman?
Jane Swift, was she?
Yeah, Jane Swift.
She wasn't elected. It's a still future. Okay, this second one is called Sleep Deprived. In 1970-71, I worked full-time as a field researcher for a prestigious all-white consulting firm of professionals in San Francisco that used federal money from the Poverty Program and Model Cities Program. Experienced the previous year, is this bothering people? This, okay. Experienced the previous year from an all-black consulting firm in Oakland, my people's skills proved useful. Over the past 3 years, I had been the single white woman in a handful of medium-sized cities on the East Coast. I asked individuals what they did, what they liked to do, what they could do, and how they could use their money. Then I wrote a composite report that reflected the views of a city's many significant officials and populations. But sometimes the task eluded me. The adventure of flying to Dayton, Ohio, reputed to be a well-managed city, dwindled after 3 weeks alone in a modest hotel with no visits to a bar or discussions with co-workers, only a TV never turned on and meals in silence. On my return to my home in Berkeley, I tried to rest from the trip. Persistent images of conversations and people passed through my mind. I gave up on sleep and went to my Marshall Kaplan Ganzen Khan office in San Francisco. Why couldn't I assess the city in Ohio? I began to see in my thoughts an exaggerated logic. Beyond words, I wanted to create something to communicate the layers of my knowledge. Perhaps like one of my heroes, Buckminster Fuller, who discovered the geodesic dome, I could build a spatial form that depicted dynamic structures. I found and bought a giant set of Tinker Toys, wooden disks for decision makers, and different color rods for relationships that linked them. A partner in the firm showed interest in my construct. "Wendy, no matter what, I shall give you a good recommendation for future employment." His words agitated me. I stayed 3 days and three nights in the office without sleeping. I broke down. I canceled my plans for a much-needed vacation in Yosemite Park with a friend. Instead, I declared, "The President of the United States must know what's going on, happening at the grassroots. I'll tell him now." I changed into my favorite outfit, a three-quarter length black skirt and grape-colored fitted jersey and black boots, made me look a 60s professional, especially when I carried my black alligator skin attaché case. I took a cab to San Francisco Airport and flew to Washington, D.C. I found myself on Pennsylvania Avenue with a rose in my empty hand. The guards at the gates of the White House loomed ahead. "Good morning. I would like to speak with the president about what is going on in the inner cities of his country. I have worked in more than 23 cities. Before any more talk, the guards called a paddy wagon and threw me in, no questions asked. At St. Elizabeth's Hospital, one threw over the cuckoo's nest, remember? I demanded in heartfelt yells to make my one prison call to my parents. "Are you okay, Wendy?" "Yes, we'll drive from Wellesley all night to reach you and free you." On came a traditional white cloth straitjacket that tied my non-combatant arms to my chest. Then a tranquilizing shot into my buttocks made me sleep in the dreary, dirty, shabby surroundings of a neglected hospital. My parents arrived. I don't know what they said or did. All I knew is I returned with them to a bucolic rest home, locked, managed by Christian Scientists. Bible lessons poured through each room's speaker. The high quality of food kept me contented for a brief respite until I returned to my parents' home and then recuperated to a woman's cooperative on Ellery Street, Cambridge. This is a hard one for me. The other one should have been, but it wasn't. Here's called Absence. Two nurses in uniform flanked me as I made my way to the pay telephone in the corridor of the crazy hospital. One offered me a meager handful of quarters to cover the expenses of calling from Boston to Bronxville, New York. I felt like an inmate who had planned and recited many times my tattered speech to my husband, an economist at the United Nations. In 1993, I received a crash course on what Gloria Steinem had been preaching for years. In 10 days of stay behind locked doors, nurses